All right. Good morning, everyone, and thank you so much for taking the time to be here. And thank you to the organizers for putting on this session on community engagement and public participation in environmental research. It's really been something that throughout my PhD work I've become more excited about. So today I'd like to share three examples from a domestic and international sphere where we've worked on integrating soil contamination with the ultimate goal of addressing human health. So I'll be talking a lot about lead. Lead, I assume we're all associate a negative, bad outcome with, but it's really, it can impact all organ systems, but at the levels especially that we're used to seeing in the United States, we're concerned about its cumulative neurotoxin effect that's particularly harmful for children. So these can be impacts such as damage to the brain and nervous system, reducing IQ, having learning and behavior problems. And there's been a lot of work that's shown this at levels that we previously thought to be safe. So back in 2012, now the CDC reduced its level of concern to a reference value, and this 10 micrograms per deciliter that used to be was really there for about 20 years. And when they reduced it to 5, that was in recognition of this IQ research, research about reduced IQ levels, but it also says that there is no safe level. So it actually represents the 97.5th percentile of blood lead levels in the United States. So if you have a child with these levels, there's clearly something we can do to reduce that exposure, since the majority of children have a lower level. And why are we concerned about kids? They're most at risk for a variety of factors, primarily the exposure pathway. They have this hand-to-mouth behavior. If you've seen a toddler running around, they'll stick everything in their mouth. And those fine soil particles, fine dust can stick to your hands, toys, and they can ingest these. They have a higher biological uptake than adults, and they're in a crucial developmental stage, so their neurological development and lead can interfere with that. How are kids exposed? I showed these three examples, but there's been a lot of great work linking soil lead exposure through blood lead work, as well through the seasonality that we can see in blood lead levels. So they tend to spike in the summer. If you have a child and they get tested for their blood lead level in the winter or in the summer, you might want to see what that is in the other season. And this is based off several works, including this one here from Leila et al., that models blood lead levels or predicts them based on climate variables and the impact that that would have on soil dust resuspension. Summer, it's drier, soil is more likely to be resuspended. And so taking this information, I've been really looking at soil lead contamination and trying to figure out what are some ways that we can reduce this exposure, especially my work started on international level. Today I'll be sharing three examples of what worked in our community participation in the sampling and the testing for lead in soils. And I'll highlight some work from high school students who find a poorly cleaned up site in Minneapolis from our collaborator, Dr. Gabriel Filippelli, and then focus on some work on residents testing in backyards in New York City, and as well parents using a field kit that really was the bulk of my first PhD work, or the first few years looking for soil lead contamination. So in Indianapolis, Dr. Gabe Filippelli started the Safe Urban Garden Initiative, and public people are able to submit a soil sample, and so similar to other programs that we've seen throughout the city, such as the urban, or throughout the country, sorry, such as the Urban Soil Institute as well in New York City. And they were able to collect up to 3,000 samples, and people receive tailored recommendations based on their soil lead concentration that they find. They've expanded to this to actually work with high school students, a project that I found very exciting, where high school students will go out as well in their AP Environmental Science class to test soil in their community. And they've worked with over 120 students, and I believe from 2013, 2016, they had actually a group of 80 students that ended up finding soil lead levels of 1,000 to 1,500, and just for reference here, 400 milligrams per kilogram is the residential limit in most places for safe soil, the EPA for safe soil where children play in. and for New York City, for New York State, the restricted residential use even. So they found levels much higher than this, and found out that this was a Superfund site that had been poorly cleaned up. So essentially they had cleaned up the actual site, but the footprint of the site, but not looked around at the neighboring communities. And so with this project, they had also formed an environmental justice collaborative, and this was a community organization that then, once empowered with these results, really pushed for, at the state and national level, for somebody to come in and clean it up. So that community action then led to EPA reopening the site, retesting, confirming the results that the students had found, and then a more comprehensive cleanup. So I find this a really great example of involving the community, doing testing with the community. You know, students are able to learn through their class while providing this crucial service for communities that a lot of them might not do testing regularly in public spaces. Moving to New York City, I've worked this last summer again with some students to collect public and private soil samples in the northern part of Brooklyn. This is the Greenpoint Williamsburg area. And a lot of this was spurred actually by work from Professor Chang out of Brooklyn College, who published a whole map of New York City soils based on samples that people had sent in. And I know somewhere on there was a thing that backyard gardens tended to be higher than community gardens. And we wanted to look at what it looked like in this area in northern Brooklyn, which is also the area with the highest blood lead levels reported for New York City. And so looking at this, we collected public samples. About 14 of them here exceed the 400, so you see the orange and the red pie side. Only 14%, so only 1%, like six samples, exceeded the 1,200. And we partnered with a local community organization that was doing a lot of outreach and information on lead, and then they actually helped us advertise through flyers and their community organizations. We sent the flyers home in school, so local schools that shared the information that we were providing these free soil testing for backyards. And when we look at those, we tested 5 to 6 samples in about 52 backyards, all in the same area. The map, of course, was showing public samples only. But 84% of those samples were above 400. And to me, what was really shocking was that 35% of the samples were actually above 1,200 parts per million. So if I looked at this in another way, this is for all the samples, 62% of all of the yards had at least one sample above 1,200. Milligrams per kilogram lead or parts per million. And these are things we wouldn't find if we weren't involving the community and sampling where kids are playing, sampling the backyards in areas that maybe there's nobody else taking responsibility for, and testing these samples. And so I want to end with an example from Peru, which is, as I mentioned, I started a lot of this work about 3 years ago, and we were looking at communities along a railway distribution line where they were transporting the ore from the mining communities down to Lima, the port where it would be shipped. So these are all in narrow valley. So we sampled kind of 60 meter intervals this whole community. It's just narrow. And here the red points about above 1,200, and the yellow is actually between 280 and 1,200, just to reflect the local standard that they were using for public health. So we found one hotspot. We did this sampling with a handheld XRF X-ray fluorescence instrument, presented these at community meetings, got sometimes reasonable turnout. We actually interviewed 137 people before and after we did these community meetings, but of those, only 10 showed up to the community meetings, which was a bit unfortunate, but 70% did say they saw a poster somewhere. And so basically, we did this first, and then we came back in, and based on blood lead data that the local government had done, reached out to people. Oh, sorry. So this, I want to zoom in here on this area in the orange square, which is our sampling for this area. And then we reached out to people who had both children with high and low blood levels and said, hey, we're piloting this field kit. So we're trying to create this field kit where you can test for lead in your soil on your own. It has a colorimetric measurement to kind of divide into high, medium, and low. The entire country didn't have an XRF at the time. So we need something else for people to at least be able to identify the hot spots, where they can then do something about those, or at least prevent that children are playing in these areas to reduce exposure. So then we worked with parents, they collected the soil sample, and they came back with these results. And we were like, oh, we've got some high spots here that we hadn't found, and we went back with an XRF. And the parents, by virtue of sampling where their children are playing and sampling as well in their own backyards, found a hotspot that we had completely missed. This area apparently had been built up on mine tailings, and they were excavating to build new homes. And in that excavation, we were digging up 2,000, 3,000 parts per million lead. And we didn't know that because we didn't cross, you know, the fences. They didn't cross into the area where they were digging up the soil, and children were actually playing in these areas as well. So again, here we found something that, without having parents sample where the kids play and in their backyards, we wouldn't have missed this, and it was very embarrassing in a way to admit that we had presented this information and had missed a hot spot of contamination that children were exposed to and we were not presenting to the community. I had mentioned that we did have blood lead data for these communities, so I wanted to look a bit at how these related. And here I'm first showing the blood lead levels of children. I have them, so all the kids under 5 are in this green box, and then between 5 and 10 in the orange, and then the greater than 10 micrograms per deciliter. It's all micrograms per deciliter. Furthest to the right. And we looked at the soil lead concentrations, just total soil here, within 100 meters of the home, and divided this again by the lead concentrations you see at the bottom. Green is below 280, and red is above 1200. And what really stood out is that we weren't seeing much of a difference between the different blood lead levels. Patterned about 25% seemed to be medium to high. And then the next step is we did this field kit where they were simulating essentially an extraction. And we wanted to compare those field kit results. And we find that the field kit results actually much better reflect the blood lead concentrations than the total soil. So for the low ones, we didn't have any high. And this method, again, is looking at simulated bioaccessible lead. You can see it there. So that increase of medium and high increases in the middle, and then again as we go to the highest portion. So this, to me, really raises the interesting question, and unfortunately, I've had a hard time getting access to blood lead data and after this to try to continue up on this study. But looking at how are we estimating blood lead level or exposure risk, and what are better ways to do this. So with that, just briefly some lessons learned. Participation really is key in community buy-in, which I'm sure we'll share a lot and discuss a lot today here. But often, are you reaching the right audience? You know, at first I was just reaching gardening groups. When I was sharing my information in New York, and I believe Dr. Filippelli had similar thing, but these communities are often not the ones most in need of exposure risk assessment. Often they're already doing raised beds, they already have all this. So with that as well, the sampling bias, who's participating, are those maybe more in rundown homes who aren't growing a garden but just have dirt and their children are playing in it, not getting the service. And how are you sharing the data? How are you communicating it back to the people? Our first effort in Peru wasn't too effective. As well as looking at how we're organizing and receiving samples, and is this something the community can be more involved in? Can you have a neighborhood collection point, something that makes it easier for people to do. We haven't been providing incentives other than the results and that we will tell you about lead and information, but definitely for some people, maybe that's not enough for providing this soil sample, especially in New York City where maybe soil is, people don't associate that there's so much soil. And really I want to leave you with this idea of the importance of public participation in sampling and what this could do for assessing child risk or how we could use this to protect child health and what data are we missing by not involving communities in these sampling events. So thank you. It was a PXRF. Yeah. So it's a portable X-ray fluorescence instrument, and this is, I mean, it's kind of like a big gun or a box with a handle on it that you can walk around in the field, and you can point it at a soil sample in the ground, or you can collect a sample in a bowl, mix it, and then point it at and analyze. And generally, in about 30 seconds, it's able to analyze concentrations for several metals using X-ray fluorescence, so it's able to excite essentially the inner electrons from an atom, and those are characteristic for each element, and so as those are pushed out, then higher level electrons fall down, that energy that they emit is also characteristic for each element. But it's really kind of a point and shoot analysis. And I'm happy to discuss this more later.
Yeah, very nice talk. I firstly, because I know like the audience sometimes is really hard to get a response, then I just ask you, could you give us some examples? What's the most difficult part when you try to reach the audience?
I'd say the beginning is always the hardest. So as you build up momentum, people talk, community organizations talk, and then you get you know, it grows exponentially how many people have heard of you, so they think, okay, I know what you're doing, you're trustworthy, I'd like to participate, or contact you on your own. So I'd probably say the beginning, and I think they're just really going into the community, and we did a lot of flyering at local organizations, businesses, and working with local community groups. Nonprofits really have been, yeah, invaluable for just helping share the message and getting community participants.
All right, thank you so much.